Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome back into another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Busy week in the NBA. We had the Derrick Rose situation unfold. DeMarcus Cousins rumors out there. Trade chatter all around. And nobody better to talk about that than Bobby Marks, our front office insider. And I begin by asking Bobby how he thinks the Derrick Rose situation was handled by the Knicks.
If I was Phil Jackson, I would have walked into that press conference, even if I had limited information and I wasn't sure where he was. Phil's the face of the organization. He needs to be, you know, right there.
Later on, we discussed another Knicks player, Carmelo Anthony, and specifically, should the Boston Celtics be kicking the tires on a potential Carmelo Anthony trade?
If you had Carmelo on Boston, I mean, could you imagine a lineup where you put him at the four or Crowder at the four and you had Horford at the five and you still have, you know, Thomas or, you know, whatever is left go? I think you'd have a dynamic offense from an offensive standpoint.
We talk about all that and more next on the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. All right, so a lot is going on in the NBA right now, but the biggest story of the week was the Derrick Rose departure from the team that broke last Monday when Rose abandoned his team, went back to Chicago, had a family issue, but didn't tell the Knicks, didn't tell anybody, wound up getting fined by the team, has been back in the lineup ever since, and the Knicks are trying to move on from that. To talk about that and a lot of other topics in the NBA, let's bring in Bobby Marks, the front office insider over at The Vertical, longtime executive in the NBA, former assistant general manager with the Brooklyn Nets. All right, Bobby, let's start there. With Derrick Rose, you know, and I chose to use the word abandoned because I think that is an abandonment. I have no problem with a player having a family issue that he has to tend to, missing a game. I mean, I've said it many times before. These athletes are not robots. They aren't just here to entertain us and have nothing else going on in their lives. When things happen, they have every right to go and deal with it like you or I would. But to leave his team the way he did, I thought that was a complete abandonment. What did you make of the situation and the Knicks' reaction, which was not to suspend but to fine Derrick Rose?
Well, Chris, I'll take it in two parts here. And, you know, I was there Monday night at that New Orleans game when all this unfolded. You're right. That is the word abandonment. And I had never seen a player, at least when I worked for the Nets, and I don't remember a case that really no-showed a game and didn't even call his team to let him know. You know, we've seen guys who have been sick. We've seen players who have family issues. But at least there's a communication line either with the trainer, the general manager, or the head coach. And there was plenty of time for Rose to either call Phil Jackson or Steve Mills or Jeff Hornacek or even another player, you know, before the game started. I mean, there was a time when he did have to take a car service to the airport, I would think. So there was a lull when you're sitting on the plane ready for that to take off, even if it was a private plane. So, yeah, I had never seen that, Chris. I've seen guys miss practice and not call, and that's probably because of a night of out too late. But that's one thing. Practice in a game is two different things here. In regards to the reaction post game, and the more you dissect it, and I talked to three teams yesterday about how they would handle a situation like that, and in each of the teams, and it was unanimous, was that they would not have put their head coach out there in a situation like that with the information they had, and it would have been the general manager or the president of the team who would have faced the media. And it reminded me a lot of, Chris, back a year ago. Remember we had that Jahlil Okafor situation?
Yep.
The incident in Boston, and then there was a bunch of other stuff that came out, and I still believe that was the downfall of Sam Hinkie, that Brett Brown was basically left to fend for Okafor in the organization because he was the spokesman, and it reminded me of Monday night. But if I was Phil Jackson, I would have walked into that press conference, even if I had limited information and I wasn't sure where he was. He's Phil's the face of the organization. He needs to be, in situations like that, he needs to be, right there.
I don't know why he doesn't understand that, or maybe it's that he just doesn't care, because the Knicks enjoyed probably their best relationship with the media, and by extension, with the city and with the fans, when Donnie Walsh was running that team. I mean, Donnie Walsh was the most accountable Knicks executive, I don't want to say ever because I don't go back that far, but at least of this century. I mean, he was constantly on the floor. You could ask him whatever you want about the team or anything else. And because of that transparency, things, at least the relationship with the media got so much better. Phil Jackson, the only interviews he's doing are these national media type interviews. He's not sitting down with beat writers, and he's not front and center. I mean, look, people have tweeted back at me and said, well, what do you expect Phil to say that Jeff Hornacek couldn't say? That's not the point. I mean, Phil Jackson runs this franchise. He's the guy that acquired Derrick Rose. He's the guy that ultimately will make the decision on a fine, on a suspension. He has to be there and take these questions. He might not like these questions. I don't think any executive would, but he has a responsibility to be front and center and answer these questions. Am I wrong there, or what do you think of that?
No, you're not wrong. And I worked for Rod Thorne for 10 years, and if it was Rod Thorne, he would have been up there on Monday night after the game. If it was Billy King or some of these other executives that I've either worked for, Ed Stefanski, we can put up there, or I have a relationship for, they would have been up there because it wasn't about the basketball game. There was no questions about the Knicks losing by 14 or 15 points that night, or why Carmelo got thrown out, or Kyle O'Quinn, but it was about Derrick Rose and really wanting answers. And if Phil had just gone up there and said he hasn't called, from the information that we have, that he is safe, and when we have more information, we'll get it out to you, and that was it. And then I don't think we would be making as much about it, and the Rose situation would it would probably still linger a little bit, but it would be somewhat closed here. And Chris, I've talked to a lot of teams, and it's not just the media that he's not, out in the public with. He's not an easy man to get in touch with. If you're going to try to make a trade proposal with the Knicks, you're not going to Phil Jackson. You're going to Steve Mills. And, that's how it's been for, the teams in the trade process, where normally you would call the president or the GM. And I know Steve's the GM there, but if I'm Archie Buford, or if I'm Sam Presti, I want to talk to Phil Jackson. If I'm going to make a proposal, and I'm not saying those are the two teams that I've been in contact with them, but I want to talk to Phil Jackson because I want to make sure that the information that I, want to get out there gets to the right person.
So what do you make of the decision to fine Derrick Rose and not suspend him? Because I was convinced he would get at least one game. I mean, it's understandable if there was a significant family issue, and it's not my place to delve into what that issue is and try to interpret how it affects Derrick Rose. But to brazenly ignore the team and to skip a game, is that not an example of conduct detrimental to the team? Is that not a perfect example of what should at least generate a one-game suspension?
Well, it's Exhibit A as far as if you determine what in the collective bargaining agreement, what is conduct detrimental to the team, is when a player doesn't show up for a game and doesn't let anyone know here. And, he got a fine equal to one game's pay, which is right around $200,000. Chris, these guys make so much money. I mean, they've made a lot of money in their career, and I know it hurts a little bit, but if you suspend a player, if you take a player away, a player minutes or a role in the rotation, that impacts one more than a monetary fine. And I mean, I guess if you're New York, the argument is, well, there, you know, the one game was the game he missed, which is not right. And I would have suspended him for that Philadelphia game on Wednesday, because how do you know this is not going to, you know, happen again? How do you know if you want to commit to him long term as a free agent, this won't, you know, occur again? I mean, can you trust the player? That would be my concern if I was in a management position from New York.
Yeah, to me, this sets kind of the standard for finable and suspendable offenses in New York. If I'm a player on the team and I have an outburst at a coach, or I wind up missing a practice, I know I can't get suspended, or at least I shouldn't be, because it's not worse than skipping a game and not telling the team. I mean, he skipped 1 of 82. And not only did he skip 1 of 82, he skipped a game that the Knicks badly needed to win, Bobby. You were there for that game. There was a sense of desperation within that team. There still is a sense of desperation within this team. They've got to start putting some wins together. And to go up against New Orleans at home, a team that's struggling, not playing good basketball, can't score on anybody at this point, and to play the way they did, obviously Derek's absence affected them on the court, but the uncertainty of where he is or where he was, several Knicks players have come out and said that was something we were thinking about during introductions, and it was on our mind during the game. His absence, not only not being there, played a role in losing the game, but not knowing where he was or what was going on, that played a role in him losing the game. So you have now set a standard. You're saying that that does not warrant a suspension. So any other player does anything that's, you know, deemed less than that shouldn't get a suspension either.
And that's where the collective bargaining agreement allows teams at their discretion. It's not like the player is suspended for an on-court incident. You know, it's basically up to the team as far as what discipline they want to impose. And when you looked at the Knicks schedule starting last Monday, I thought that they would have to run the table that week to really get themselves, back in the mix. And I'm not saying back in the mix, you know, that as the eighth seed, but, you know, kind of get back in the middle of the pack, that, you know, that 4, 5, 6 range at least. And then you lose to New Orleans, you lose at Philly. You're lucky you get Chicago, a depleted Bulls team with no Butler, and you're able to win that game. I thought there was a sense of desperation before that game, especially against a New Orleans team that has somewhat struggled. We talked about them from an offensive standpoint, and then you let that team come out and score 110 points.
Yeah, it's bad. And I honestly don't know that this story is over either. I'm not entirely convinced that this was just a personal thing. Derek obviously has had his issues with Jeff Hornacek, benched in the fourth quarter of the Milwaukee game for Ron Baker. If that continues, and look, Jeff Hornacek's trying to win games here. Ron Baker is going to be a ball mover and a better defender. He's got to play Ron Baker in the fourth quarter of some games. I wouldn't be surprised if something more came of this down the line. But let's look at the Knicks before the trade deadline. You mentioned that, you know, executives out there don't know exactly who to call, or at least they're not able to get a hold of Phil Jackson with trade possibilities. Carmelo Anthony here. Now, he's got the no trade clause, and he said publicly he wants to stay in New York. But if you're running the Knicks, how do you sit down with Carmelo? Do you try to have a frank discussion with him? Because, you know, best case scenario, at least to me, the Knicks make the playoffs and then Cleveland wipes them out in the first round. Worst case scenario is they slip to 11th or 12th or 10th or 11th or whatever it is in the Eastern Conference, and they become kind of a laughingstock over the second half of the year. What do you do if you're Phil Jackson and Steve Mills in terms of communicating with Carmelo Anthony?
Well, I would want to sit down and at least at the All-Star break, and that's going to be before the trade deadline, and we'll see where this Knick team is. He's owed the rest of this year. He's got 2 more years after this with a player option for that second year. It's a high number though, Chris, and when you look at his number, then you also attach a $10 million trade bonus that will get spread out over the next couple of years. So it's the no trade clause, it's the trade bonus. you know, can a team take him in at a $29-30 million player? That's literally a 25% of your cap right there. And he is still an effective offensive player, but I don't think he is your number one guy. He would certainly be a nice core piece or complementary piece on some of these really good teams. But if you look at teams who are going to have cap space this summer, it's all rebuilding teams. I mean, that's how it is. All the good teams have either used their money or they have their own key free agents, you know, come up this upcoming summer. So if he ever did get to a point and said, I will waive my no trade for Boston or the Clippers or Cleveland, I just don't know. You know, I don't see the right match from any of these teams here.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to bring that up because there's no obvious trading partner out there. There's no, you know, Chicago, what they were a couple of years ago when they were kind of relentless in their pursuit. Houston, I would imagine not a great option, especially with Mike D'Antoni there right now. The Clippers aren't going to trade one of their core players for Carmelo Anthony at this point. Boston is at least a little bit intriguing because I can envision Brad Stevens doing some interesting things with Carmelo in the lineup. And if you're looking at what the Celtics need to advance, at least in the Eastern Conference, it would be a wing scorer. The whole Gordon Hayward stuff came up, last month, and people kept connecting it to race. But the reality is Boston needs a Gordon Hayward type of scorer. They need a 20-point-per-game guy on the perimeter. It's as simple as that. They have been relying on Isaiah Thomas. We're going to get to him in a second. But, you know, they need a second option to succeed in the postseason. I'm not sure that Al Horford is that reliable fourth quarter scoring option that they can go to. So if I'm the Celtics, I would kick the tires on that. I would ask the Knicks what the price would be. I wouldn't give up anything super significant. And when I say that, I wouldn't give up one of the Brooklyn draft picks. I'd be willing to break up my logjam in the backcourt with Avery Bradley and Marcus Smart. I put Jay Crowder obviously in play because there's obviously Carmelo would sort of take his slot in the coming years, but I would explore that if I were the Celtics. How would you see Carmelo fitting in on that team?
Well, I think when you look at Boston and some of the other teams, it's almost like you need another go round of the summer of where money went last year for some of these teams to have some high salaries. And in Boston's case, you've got the Zeller, Amir Johnson, some of those higher, from a salary standpoint. But if you had Carmelo on Boston, I mean, could you imagine a lineup where you put, him at the four or Crowder at the four, and you had Horford at the five, and you still have Thomas or, whatever is left go. I think you'd have a dynamic offense from an offensive standpoint. Would not help, what you've seen, especially in that Toronto game this past week, as far as from a little bit of a deficiency from a rebounding standpoint. But that would be their key free agent that, basically when they have cap space this summer, that would have been their addition. So it's a matter of, what you want to, give up. Chris, I was, when I was in New Jersey, I sat through 6 months of, Carmelo Anthony, as far as us going out trying to get him. I had a binder that started with 3 pages that probably ended with 200 pages of different trade scenarios. And when I look back on those scenarios then compared to now, I don't see the New York, if they did put him on the market, getting that right value back. I mean, back then it was at least 2 picks were, in our case, 3 picks, a core player, or a young player and some fillers. And I don't see that market for him right now.
No, I don't see it either. And like I said, you've got to be real careful with what you give up to get a player like that. You don't gut your roster for a guy mid-30s who's clearly kind of sliding a little bit this year. But I would explore it if I were the Celtics, because you put a Carmelo next to Isaiah and you're going to score late in games. I mean, over the weekend, Isaiah Thomas continues to, to me, Bobby, not only make his case to be an all-star starter, but I think he's worked his way into the conversation for MVP. I don't think he's a favorite by any stretch or the front runner. He might not even be in the top five, but if we're going to have a top 10 discussion about MVP, he's got to be in it. I mean, his numbers over the last month are comparable to the numbers that Steph Curry put up during his MVP season. Now, it's a smaller sample size, obviously, but he's scoring in the fourth quarter. He's doing it when everybody in the gym knows that he's getting the ball late in game. So it's not like there's an element of surprise there. He's been fantastic. I mean, what have you seen from Isaiah over the last few weeks?
He is the closer. I mean, I think that's what his nickname should be as far as his ability to close out games. And, you know, I just look at him from where he was in Sacramento and where he was now. I don't even know if we put that, I guess, that half year in Phoenix into the equation. But, you know, his third year in the league, Chris, he averaged the same minutes as right now, 34 and 20 points a game. Now he's plus +8. Same minutes. So he has certainly gotten better. He's more efficient. You know, his field goal percentage is at, you know, right around 46, right? Last year was 42. You know, from the line, assists. There's a lot of good things. And players want to play with him because you know every night he's going to come out, win or lose, you know, that you are going to get the, you know, the maximum effort. I'm not putting him into the equation of a, you know, an Allen Iverson type player, but, you know, because I know Iverson was, from a speed standpoint, was quicker, but, you know, from a durability standpoint, I mean, he played 82 games last year. He didn't miss a game, you know, and he's going to play, you know, close to that this upcoming year. So, you know, he's certainly an all-star. He'll probably make all NBA. Which is, it was a hard feat to come by. And I think we should start putting him in the that equation with the likes of Jimmy Butler and Harden and Westbrook. You know, LeBron is always there. I think the guys in Golden State will probably split some of these votes with Curry, Durant. But this is as deep as a field as I've seen where there really is no clear cut, you know, MVP candidate.
No, Harden to me is probably the front runner right now just because of the Rockets record. But it's a fluid a race at the moment. I mean, it's up for grabs in the second half of the season.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
If you're enjoying this program, then check out the MMQB podcast with Peter King.
What's the one thing that you take away from Bill Belichick and you say, this is the thing that everybody else is missing?
Everything is about supplying information to Bill so he can make the decisions. And Bill has the front office and the coaching staff all on the same page. That's the biggest difference. And there's never a day off with Bill Belichick.
Listen and subscribe to new episodes every Wednesday of the MMQB podcast with Peter King.
All right, let's move out to the Western Conference for a minute. And there was a report this week, something we've talked about in the past over at the Vertical, that DeMarcus Cousins, if he's handed an offer for a $200 million extension from the Sacramento Kings, that he's going to accept it. Now, that's not all that surprising. You know, you don't turn down $200 million offers. It's also not all that surprising, the suggestion that the Kings would offer that, because Vivek Ranadive, from what I'm told very recently, remains enamored with DeMarcus Cousins as his franchise player. I mean, is giving DeMarcus Cousins that type of offer, is that the right move for Sacramento?
Well, it's the cards you've been dealt, and you have, if you don't, and if you, let's say if you, want to go in a different direction, do you have the ability to attract an all-star and an all NBA player? You know, let's take some of the other antics off the court. And I don't think you do. It'll be interesting with Sacramento. If they do the extension this summer, you know, won't kick in till the summer of 18. Can they get into the playoffs this year and use that as a kind of a recruiting tool for free agency, because they possibly could have $40 to $50 million based on what you do for your roster. So this is kind of your really last year to, with this Cousins extension looming. But that was the goal of the CBA, was to incentivize players to remain with their team if they hit certain achievements, and you'll be paid at a larger salary amount. So I understand it from both sides. From a management side, and you hadn't been to the playoffs, and you're thinking, well, can you win with this guy, you know, for the next 4 or 5 years at making $40 million, and can we get better players around here? And then from an ownership standpoint, he's your best player. He's, you know, your clear cut best player, and he's a probably a top 10 NBA player. And if I don't pay him, you know, then, you know, who am I going to replace him with? There's not like there's an influx of young kids waiting to, you know, come up the ladder here.
Yeah. And to be clear on the report, it was that the Kings plan to offer that type of extension, and listening to DeMarcus's public comments, you are led to believe that he'd be very receptive to accepting that deal. I think it's a big mistake. I do. I think the faction within the Sacramento organization that wants to trade him has to be more proactive, and they have to have their voice heard, because that faction is growing, and it's loud, and it reaches the higher levels of the Kings front office. I mean, I think there are plenty of people in that organization that realize that, you know, he's got a decent trade value right now. Can you imagine? I mean, what would that trade value be, Bobby, if he's making $35, $40 million per year? I mean, he's intriguing because of his talent, but teams that I talk to are not equally as intrigued, but that intrigue is amplified by a manageable contract. If he all of a sudden is owed, you know, is getting $35 million per year for 5 or 6 years, how attractive is that? I wouldn't touch him for that type of money unless his behavior improves and the team around him improves.
Well, Chris, and it goes back to the discussion we started with and with Carmelo Anthony, and not because of him being untouchable for Carmelo, some of his antics, but for more from a salary standpoint and how that high that number is and how hard it is to move it. And that's going to be, if you look at this new CBA, that a little bit of the downfall when you reward players with this designated player veteran extension, where their salaries are going to be so high. And if it is a piece, you know, the goal is that you want that player to be here for the long term because he is a franchise level player. So now you have a player like Cousins who is, an all NBA player, but can he be a franchise level player and kind of put these guys on his back and lead him to the playoffs and do some good things and attract free agents here? And if you do the extension and you realize, you know what, I don't think he is, you know, part of the future. Now you're looking at, when you look at teams' rosters, you know, a lot of the teams that do have these, you know, designated player veteran, they're going to keep them. You know, they're going to keep the Steph Currys of the world or the Jimmy Butlers or the Kawhi Leonard down the road. And then you're going to see a huge number and drop off. Then you're going to look at guys who make 15 to 20 million. So that would be the challenge if down the road you sign them to the extension and then you want to move him. That's a lot of money for a team to swallow, and it will certainly impact their roster.
Yeah, and guys, you know, free agents don't want to play there right now. I mean, they've been used as leverage from multiple free agents over the last few summers. I mean, Wesley Matthews is a name that jumps to mind. Signed with Dallas and, you know, played that game with Sacramento because that's an offer, a competing offer that they can use. There's a handful of guys that have done that over the years. I don't know that tying such a big number on your cap to a player that's so volatile is the right thing to do, but we'll see. I know there's plenty of time to between now and then for different things to happen. All right, I want to talk too about the Cleveland Cavaliers and some news that came out of Cleveland this week, which is the Cavs really need more practice. And I don't know that I've ever heard a team at least not a team on Cleveland's level with the kind of chemistry and the continuity that they have with that roster suggest that. What did you make of the Cavs and LeBron and Kevin Love talking about how this team needs more practice time?
I think it's just the grind of the season, and you know, it's
wouldn't they want days off then? Like, can we get a day off? Like, how about that?
You know, I think they're a little cranky right now. I think that's where we're at. I think they had that. I think that Portland trip might have did them in as far as getting in late and, you know, have to play. And I saw Ty Lue complaining. And why are we even playing that state of emergency? So I think I think when they were asked a question, they were a little bit lack of sleep and a little bit cranky here. And then you turn around and you have a good win in Sacramento on Friday night, where you dominated the whole game, and now you know Korver finally you know, it was the Korver that we saw in Atlanta and had a good game there. And I get it. It's, you know, Chris, it's a long year, you know, you cover it, you're in city to city and it takes a toll on your body. It's not like you're, you know, an NFL, you know, 16 or 17 game, you know, or, you know, weeks, season, or even MLB, and you're in cities for a week or whatever, and you're constantly traveling, and your practice time is limited. You know, you're not going to practice on a second night of a back to back, and you're nicked up with some injuries, and I know that they, you know, from what LeBron has preached, that he's looking for another point guard, and if you probably talk to David Griffin, he needs a playmaker. And you know, meanwhile, they're, you know, 31-9 and have the best record in the East, and are a likely shoo-in to get back to the NBA Finals for a third year in a row. And you can't have too many toys. I always said that what you have is, you've got to find that right balance there.
Yeah, and that's the second peculiar comment in the last few weeks coming out of Cleveland. The first was LeBron. It's pretty public declaration that the team needs another point guard. I mean, is that big an issue for the Cavs right now? Somebody to back up Kyrie Irving? I know Dellavedova was critical in a variety of different ways, and Mo Williams retiring hurt them, and Kay Felder hasn't really worked out there. But I mean, how much of a sense of urgency should Cleveland have before the deadline to go out and get some kind of usable backup?
Well, I think for the regular season, I think it would help from a depth standpoint, and when some of these players are not playing on a back to back and you need to rest, you know, from a longevity standpoint, that it would help. When we get to the playoffs, I don't see, if they go out and get a backup point guard, how much of an impact, because you have to look at how they play, and most of the time the ball's in LeBron's hands at the end of games. And you know, we saw last year with Mo Williams and Dellavedova kind of, I guess, shared that backup role during the playoffs. So I think if it's, you know, if it's a Mario Chalmers or a Jarrett Jack or one of these veterans, yeah, I mean, I think it's good to have, because it gives, you know, Kyrie Irving a blow, and you can kind of start to stagger, you know, some of these minutes. And, you know, to go out and find a playmaker, what Griff had, you know, reported to say, I think it was in ESPN, is, I don't know what your assets are now. You don't have any more picks really left until 2021. And you've got your top heavy with your core guys, with LeBron and Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love and J.R. Smith's hurt and Shumpert. And then, you know, basically your other, you know, movable piece is Channing Frye. So I don't think it, you know, a Channing Frye gets you a guy that can make that big of an impact. So I just don't see, you know, I mean, you know, you never know. Griff's been able to pull a couple rabbits out of the hat the last 2 years with Korver and Frye and move Varejao improve the roster. So, you know, it'll be interesting to watch here.
Yeah. I think the Cavs' best chance of upgrading that spot is to hope that somebody comes out in the buyout market. I mean, I think that's where they're likely to find the best value. I mean, there are some pretty high profile names that could wind up bought out before March 1st. I mean, we talked about Derrick Rose, and while I would say it's unlikely he gets bought out, I don't think we'd rule it out. If it continues to deteriorate there, if you know, Ron Baker gets more minutes, if the team falls out of playoff contention, I could see that happening. And the other guy is Rajon Rondo. You know, Rondo is still kind of in and out of the rotation in Chicago right now, but it's clear at this point that the Bulls don't see him as part of their long-term future. And if they are getting enough out of the Michael Carter Williams, was it Jerry and Grant combination at the point guard spot, then, you know, maybe they'd feel like Rondo's not worth the, you know, the kind of hassle or aggravation, if he does turn out to be that, of having around. I mean, either one of those guys would be, I mean, ideal if you're the Cavaliers.
You know what, Chris? You know what a good name would be, and I don't know if he would ever do it, would be Deron Williams.
Yep.
To ask for a buyout. He's in his last year of his deal at $9 million. The likelihood of him returning to Dallas is probably low, because they'll have a top six pick, and they'll probably draft a guard, and they'll have cap space to go out and fill their roster. I know he's got his roots there, but you're looking at, for the last, you know, if it's a March 1, you're looking at 3 months. And can Deron, if you ever go that route, can you get him back on the map here? Because he has certainly fallen off. And I think that's where his role will be moving forward is in a high quality backup type player and not in a starter role. So if I was a Darren Williams and I'm headed to the lottery in a Dallas team, and if I want a chance to win a championship or play in the playoffs and go far, that would be certainly something I would want to look into.
Man, I mean, you bring up Darren Williams and it made me think of, if 3 years ago, what would we have said if we said that guys like Rajon Rondo, who's 30 years old, Derrick Rose, who's 28, and Darren Williams, who's 32, that these guys would be, afterthoughts and potentially on the buyout market, as options for a team desperate for a backup point guard. It's incredible. These were the elite at one point. Maybe Williams, you have to go back a little bit further to declare him elite, but it's, 3 years, 4 years for Derrick Rose. But before he got his body started getting ravaged in Boston, before he got his knee torn up, Rajon Rondo was one of the best point guards in the game. I mean, these are guys, Bobby, that should be in their primes. I mean, this is 28 to 32 are your prime years as a basketball player. It's kind of amazing that we're talking about, these once elite point guards as potential backup options for the Cavaliers.
Well, and when we made the trade for Williams in 2011, you could probably make the argument that him and Chris Paul were 1 and 2, and you could probably make the argument that Darren was probably a little bit ahead of him at that time. And now we see Chris Paul still kind of at that franchise level player, and now yep. We're talking about Darren Williams, who, one of the most rare cases, I guess you can kind of put him up with Josh Smith, where you see a player who's set to earn, at $40 million plus left on his deal, gets stretched, from Brooklyn a year ago, or I guess, two summers ago. And now we're talking about him as a buyout guy and a guy who is on a 1 year contract like Rondo. I mean, Rondo technically is on a 1 year, deal with Chicago here.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now you mentioned Chris Paul, and I wanted to ask you about the Clippers, who continue to kind of putter along. They'll be a top three seed in the Western Conference, and they'll get at least to that second round. But are they a team that has to do something before the deadline? And if so, I mean, what do they do? I mean, they don't really have a lot of, I would say, attractive assets outside of their core four.
They don't, and that is the key. Their picks are out, so you're not going to use those as an asset. It has not been a good place for young kids to go to develop, when they have, drafted players. So you don't have some guys, in the stable that you can possibly move, is the Pierce contract a movable? Yeah. Because, he's going to retire next year. So it's basically an expiring, but he's only at 3.5. I mean, is Redick an appeal? Because can you afford him? When you get into free agency, and I don't know if you can, Chris. I know that it's a wealthy owner there, but when you look at them, I mean, can you afford a team that's going to have $150 million payroll and $100 million in tax? I mean, that's where you're looking at the Clippers, go this summer if they keep this team intact, and it will probably be a team that loses in the second round. And it's another one of those teams where you have three guys making $20 million plus, and then after that, you've got the Jamal Crawfords and the Austin Rivers, guys who are, key reserves, Wes Johnson at 5'8", Bamute at 2. I mean, they're all small numbers. So to go out and get an impact in the, and they might be one of those teams, a team to watch come March 1st, as far as from a potential, buyout standpoint, but they've got to get Blake back. I think that's going to be, key. And it's almost like we talked about it last year. It's like, we got to get Blake back. it was the mm-hmm. same situation, different, elements here, but, get him back, get him healthy, get to mid-April, at one piece with this team and see what happens when you get to the playoffs.
Yeah, I don't think the Clippers do anything significant at the trade deadline. I think you're right. I think they're among the players at the buyout deadline for useful players that get let go, because they've got to go all in this year, don't they? I mean, they've got to at least, this summer, if they wind up flaming out in the second round, Doc Rivers, his staff, Lawrence Frank, they're going to have some tough decisions to make. They're going to have to decide, how much do you pay J.J. Redick? They're going to have to decide if this core is worth keeping together for another run, or if do they have to kind of retool it, tear it down, whatever phrase you want to use. But for this year, they've just got to go all in. They've got to maybe cross their fingers that something happens with Golden State and hope that that lightning in the bottle that they've been hoping to catch with all their guys healthy that actually pays off, that this team morphs into that dominant playoff team that Rivers and some of the players think they can be, if they're fully healthy.
Well, and that, when we talked in October, when we said who has the most pressure, and it's certainly the Clippers are up there, just based on, you've got two guys based, your franchise players are in their, technically in their last year. So you've built a team, if you weren't all in, then you would have let Jamal Crawford go or Austin Rivers go, and you wouldn't be a luxury tax team this year. And you would hit the reboot a little bit, and you'd look to move a Blake Griffin, in that direction. But you look at Paul, his number's $36 million. Blake Griffin's $31 million. I mean, that's, $67 million with those two guys just for next year. And you add DeAndre, and that's another 22. So the numbers are going to get up there. And I think if this team was in the East, could they be in the Eastern Conference finals battling Cleveland every year? Yeah, they could. But out West, I don't know how they are going to get past the Golden States of the world. San Antonio is still strong. Houston, we've seen to get over that hump.
Yeah, I don't know either, but this is going to be kind of their last stand, I think. You mentioned pressure. I want to finish with this. And, I've been watching a lot of Detroit lately, and they just seem to be a complete mess right now. They've fallen outside the playoff bracket, not too far outside, because the Eastern Conference, you can climb your way back in with a good week in the bottom half of that bracket. But, I mean, how much pressure is Stan Van Gundy feeling right now? He's the coach. He's the executive. And this team, which looked like, I was among the people that thought they would make a run at a 4-5 seed in the East after the way they finished last year. They were young, they were talented, they acquired Tobias Harris midseason. What's happened with the Pistons this year, and what does Stan Van Gundy do about it?
Well, a couple things here, and it's funny, Chris, is that you had the Reggie Jackson injury, but when he came back, you were 500. So yep. It wasn't like you were 3-12 and you're trying to make up ground. So, And I like their additions in the offseason with the Ish Smiths and the John Luer. I thought they could be complementary pieces. I look at Andre Drummond, Chris. I don't know if he has embraced the franchise level role that comes with that salary, as far as a guy to get on my back. And he's still young. And is it just the growing pains of doing so? I watched him last night Friday night against in Utah. And get their doors blown off in the second half here, and it's a weird mix. We thought that maybe Stanley Johnson would be ready to take that next step, and he hasn't. But here's another team who did all their spending in July, got $96 million in guaranteed contracts for next upcoming summer, and then you've got Kentavious Caldwell-Pope as a restricted free agent. So how much do you want to spend for a 500 team? Do you want to spend $120 million? So they're going to have a lot of decisions internally. Could a guy like Caldwell-Pope, possibly be on the open market when we get to mid February, especially if you don't know if you can, you can resign him. He's got Rich Paul as an agent. We've seen Rich draw a hard line in prior, prior summers during free agency, Tristan Thompson, Eric Bledsoe, to name a few players there. So I thought that getting into the playoffs last year, even if to lose to Cleveland in the first round, was the best thing that could happen, because it gave them that experience. And now we've taken a step back here.
Is there, you mentioned Caldwell-Pope on the market. Are they a team to watch at the deadline in terms of making something significant, to bolster their lineup or to tear it down? I mean, we know Atlanta is out there. The Paul Millsap's off the market stuff. Nobody really believes that. He's off the market until he's back on, is how it kind of goes. But who's the team out there that you're keeping your eye on as we kind of approach the 1 month until the trade deadline, Mark?
It's all those teams that are in that, that 7-8, and then kind of just on the outside, the New Orleans of the world. We can talk about Detroit, I don't think Portland, just because
Portland, would you entertain the idea of trading McCollum?
Chris, almost impossible to trade unless you're going to move him to Philly, because he's got that poison pill provision in his contract based on his rookie extension, because okay. You're not going to get true, the value. It's not really, it's a formula where what you take back. It's got, you know, it's the average of the contract, and what you're trading out is, you know, a smaller number. So, you know, teams that have cap space could take him, but then you're going to have to really, like, you know, get back picks. You can't really do with salary because it won't match up. So I think that would be really hard to move any of those guys who signed extensions here. But, you know, teams like Denver's got a lot of assets. They've got a lot, and they've got a lot of players coming back on, who will be back next year. A lot of young players. How important is it to them to take that next step in the next 3 months? New Orleans, we've talked about them at length. Would they trade a first round pick just to get in? I could certainly see that happening. Washington, another team. It will be interesting. Those teams that are kind of just hanging on for a playoff spot, right? And the teams right behind them.
Yeah. I'm to follow up on the Blazers. I wouldn't deal McCollum even if he didn't have that poison pill. I mean, you build around a young backcourt like that. You don't, and they're under contract long-term, him and Damian Lillard. You add to that. I know some of the contracts on the books are exorbitant, and they're going to have to do some creative bookmaking to make signings in the future. But when you have what is, in my opinion, the second best backcourt in the NBA, you don't break that up. You keep it together.
No, and what when you look at it is, if you ever did move a CJ McCollum, do you have faith that you can go out in free agency and get a player that can kind of duplicate that? Unless
he's getting better by the year.
Yeah, he is. I mean, he is almost getting up to that. You know, I mean, as good as Lillard is, but there, you know, it was almost like one and two, and now it's like 1A and 1B with both players. And and especially when Damian was out with his injury, that he, how he was, played at a, elite level. So no, I wouldn't do anything, especially when you have a young player under contract for the next, four plus years, and to get rid of him because your team is not playing as well and that you feel like you need to get assets. You remember, they got two first round picks this year. They've got their own, and they've got that Cleveland pick now. So that's something that you can possibly dangle when we get to the trade deadline, and when we get, possibly after the season.
I think there's a reality that a lot of fan bases have to kind of accept, which is that your team is not going to compete for anything until 2019-20 at the earliest. Just not. I mean, there's this league is going to be controlled by Cleveland and by Golden State, and on the outside, maybe Toronto or the Clippers / Spurs. Until then, until you get to 2019, you're just not going to compete. Now, and teams should build their rosters accordingly. You know, build around young talent and be ready to jump in there, like a Milwaukee might be, like a Boston might be, like a Utah might be, to step into that void once Golden State and Cleveland kind of, come back to the pack.
Realistic expectations. That's the word. Yep. And that's how you have to look at things, where the league is right now with out West, and where it is in the East with Cleveland and Golden State. And I think as long as you have a plan in place and you follow that plan and you don't deviate it, and it's okay to, if you're talking to your season ticket holders or your marketing people, or you're doing a town hall, you don't have to give out all the information, but it's okay to lay out what your plan is and how you're going to build the team, because then those people who buy tickets or buy sponsors feel like they're part of the process with you right there. And I think when teams don't do that, then that's where people kind of get frustrated. If you're a team like Boston, even though where they are, the three seed right now in the East, they've got a plan in place. And I know Danny would love to move some of those picks if he can get a all-star level player, but there's no all-star level players out there for right now to get.
Well, Bobby, this podcast has exceeded my expectations, as it always does with you. Thanks for taking some time to jump on here, and we will see you on thevertical.com with the two-man game videos that we'll be taping later on this week.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, that's it for this week. My thanks to Bobby Marks for joining the show. A reminder, you can check out all my archive podcasts on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, leave a comment, post a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same Game Parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.